Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, on the road. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how fasting or caloric restriction helps fight a major killer, fatty liver disease. The latest from a German research institute on that issue. We're also going to look today at probiotics. They can actually mitigate stress. And this is from a major institute in Japan. They want to talk about how probiotics can also separately stop menopausal-like bone loss from Emory and Georgia State University's research, and pomegranate. Wow, it can serve as a backup ovary, according to this research, that has enormous implications, as well as eating nuts. We're talking about any kind of nut is linked to lower risk of colon cancer from Seoul National University College of Medicine. And traditional foods, you know, your good, wholesome, clean, natural, plant-based diet puts chemotherapy to shame, according to Sergi of GreenMedInfo. And also, we're going to examine a new study of how fructose alters our genes in the brain and can literally sabotage learning and memory. From our audio clips today, we're going to look at how Robert Wright sets Donald Trump straight on what immigration really means, and it's not what Trump has stated. And also Matt Damian speaking the truth about civil disobedience, why we should be disobedient. First, the largest single immediate exodus of a city in Canada's history happened in the last 5 days. 82,000 people had to get out of town or they'd have been killed. A major fire, and it's right at the tar sand pits. Remember when I said 4 years ago, I said, wouldn't it be better to be prepared for an emergency and hope it never comes than have an emergency and you're unprepared? These people were completely unprepared. Thousands of homes destroyed. And so bad is this storm. It's still expanding. It's not being dealt with. And it may or may not ignite these huge tar sands, which are the largest reserve of oil in the world, right up there with Saudi Arabia. But it's a dirty oil. Very, very destructive to the environment to get it out. Very cost prohibitive to get it shipped and then processed. That was the oil that was coming down from the Canadian tar sands that we all tried to stop. But the State Department gave it a green light, and the president wanted it to happen. Anything to the contrary, according to the WikiLeaks cables, was just politics. So there were people who didn't know it was going to happen a day before it did. And then when it did, it was too late. All they could do was run. Recently, a friend of mine told me about just driving down through the Keys. I've driven through the Keys many times. Beautiful environment. And it kind of reminds you what it was like during the 1950s. From, not that I was there, and I wasn't. I was just a little tiny kid. But it shows you that it has that memorabilia feeling to it. Not today. Real estate brokers are hawking all great place, the Keys. Not true. The normal evening tide coming in is now so high, it's covering streets. In the morning, you could have upwards of a foot or more of water. And with that comes the stench, and with that comes the mosquitoes. And yet, no one seems to pay attention to that. The same is true of Miami. You have a lot of speculators going into Miami. Understand who's buying some of these very expensive, way overpriced apartments and penthouses. Not your average person. Some of these people, it is my opinion, are drug people. No questions asked. They just buy it. It's generally an offshore corporation that owns the title. No one can find out who the true owner is. It's a good way of laundering money. But that automatically forces the whole value of a neighborhood up, and that creates a bubble. And then in come the speculators on top of them, and then in come the real estate promoters. Oh, you got to get here. Hottest item in town. New 9,000 square foot apartment going for X amount, and everywhere you look, you know, it's just gold. It's fool's gold. My suggestion, based upon my personal belief, Miami is dead. Las Vegas is dead. Major cities are dying. Chicago will be the next major city to die. What do I say about Chicago? 3,000 millionaires left Chicago in the last 12 months. There's still a lot more, but the people who see what's coming leave. That's generally true. It's like I visualize it this way. Long before you and I would ever know there's a problem in Phil Tremor, horses have already picked it up and are running. They're trying to get away. They can sense it long before anyone else. Birds the same way. But we not only have lost our sense of what is appropriate places to live, we have intentionally anesthetized our sensitivity to, should we be living in a place simply because it's a bubble? The answer is no. Think of the tens of millions of Americans that got creamed, thinking, oh my God, my value of my real estate was $100,000, now it's $300,000. I got $200,000, I can do whatever I want with. No, you can't. That is not an equity. That is an illusionary figure. It's not grounded in the 1 to 1.5% increase per year in the actual historical value of real estate. When you're getting these massive increases, it's speculative. So what comes with it? A karmic lesson. Those who promote speculation to people who may or may not be aware of the risks, they'll be affected too. Because generally they're the ones who keep their money on the table when they should have taken it and put it somewhere else. So I don't believe anyone should be investing in Miami or the entire east coast of Florida. Remember what happened to 82,000 people last week and is still happening to this day. And it'll hit other places in Canada. Worst fire of towards people in Canadian history within the last 5 days. And it's expanding. No one had prepared for it. Everyone thought it would never happen until it did. So there are places in the United States that I have visited. I've done the analysis. I've looked at the rising tide. And what's rising at night in Miami? The tide. So much so that the entire street, West Street and Alton Road, which are the two streets that run up the from down First Street clear up, they're flooded every night. The city is spending millions, tens of millions of dollars to pump the water out and into the bay, which then goes right back around to the Atlantic Ocean because it's connected and does it all over again. And it's getting worse and worse and worse. So on the one hand, you can say, but look, someone just spent $50 million for an apartment. And I'm saying, and the water's rising. Someone else spent $100 million and the water's rising. The idea that someone is stupid enough or irresponsible enough to invest in a dying city does not mean that people should speculate and profit from it. And if you lose your ass in it, you deserve it. Then you've gotten that little Raggedy Ann, you're going to get hurt karmically. So don't come crying when your greed, your avarice, your insensitivity to anything that's realistic and environmental, come snapping back at you, because it will. We're in a bubble. I'm going to tell you the bad news about the economy, how bad it's getting, and yet Wall Street will not acknowledge it. The federal government will not acknowledge it. The media will not acknowledge it. I'm telling you, when you have a 35% increase in unemployment in 1 month, the month of April, better pay attention. Better pay attention. Better stop buying stuff. Literally stop buying everything you don't need and sell what you don't have to have. Because the dollar is going to collapse. It's not, is it going to collapse? It's going to collapse so bad because we have nothing backing it up. Oh, we do have the highest percentage of debt to gross domestic product of any country in the world. You thought Greece was bad at 150% debt to gross domestic product? Do the math. We have 16 to 17 billion gross domestic product, and we have over $120 trillion in confirmed debt. That's not specious or speculative. Well, how many times does 16 go into 125? That means we're the most indebted nation on the planet, that we cannot ever pay this money back, and we have nothing backing it up. Nothing. Zero. Zip. So what are you going to do? The Fed's going to print more money to buy bonds? Well, the bond market is a bubble market. It's going to collapse. The equity market is a huge bubble. It's going to collapse. The dollar is going to drop like a lead balloon. All I can do is share this information and then show me where I've been wrong on any of these predictions in the last, let's say, let's just go back last 8 years. We predicted the great stock sell-off. We predicted the collapse of the bubbles, and it happened. I did a documentary on it that took 7 years because it didn't end. I just wanted to keep bringing it up to date, called Poverty Inc. So I'm telling you today, I'm going to go a little further in this a little later. So let's, because I'm just so concerned that it's right in front of everyone and they're not willing to look at it. It's right in front of you. And yet greed and, well, there's still money on the table. I want it one last go around. Okay. But what if nature gets there first? Let's begin our discussion on health and nutrition issues, which are always positive because it gives us something we can do in a constructive way every single day to improve the quality of our lives. I remember a Dr. Alan Cott. He was a psychiatrist, board certified. Wasn't the easiest person to work with, nor was he even easiest to understand. He was a very brilliant man, and he frequently talked in deep theoretical constructs. But more often than not, he was absolutely right. And I did a project with him. We worked at the Institute on two projects together, and we wrote an article together. And it was based upon he had heard that I had fasted some laboratory mice that I had borrowed because if I didn't take them, they were going to be used in a chemotherapy experiment downstairs where the doctors were all looking for some new chemotherapy, and they didn't last very long. But my upstairs, they got to live open, organic food, beautiful music, natural lighting, no restrictions, that 3,000 square foot to run around, and they were healthy and they lived longer than their normal lifespan. But then I fasted them, which meant that I cut back on the total caloric intake, and then about every fifth day, they would have juices all day long and nutrients in the juices, like amino acids and whatnot, fibers, but no solid food. Lo and behold, they lived 22% longer than an equally matched group that were fed the same good healthy food every day. Cott heard about this, and he came over. He said, what do you make of this? And I said, well, I believe it has to do with the mitochondria. I have to believe it has to do with metabolism. And I believe it has to do with we're simply overworking our systems because we're constantly feeding it. Now, if we're constantly feeding, we have breakfast, then we have mid-morning snack, then we have lunch, then we have mid-afternoon snack, and then we have dinner, we have late evening snack. We have food in our stomach nonstop. And it takes a lot of energy, especially with animal proteins, with the nitrogen load, to break that down. And then you have to detoxify animal proteins because of urea and ammonium, and that's bad for the kidneys, bad for the liver. So, and then the meat is very congesting. It has no fiber, but it does have chemicals, and that can cause irritation and inflammation in the intestine. So by giving them a plant-based diet, and that's what they got a vegan diet, and giving them lots of fresh organic juices, healthy juices every day. I made them every day, gallons and gallons, and they lived very healthy. So he studied this, and he decided, let's try this in a study we did in humans. And we found that people were able to lose weight, have more energy, and a lot of common conditions they had, like splitting nails, falling out of hair, floaters in the eyes, all kinds of things, there was a difference. There was some improvement, and in some cases, major improvement. So he wrote about it, and he would later write a book on it. And then he would become like the dean of American fasting physicians. And he saved a lot of people's lives. And he didn't get the credit he deserves, but he was one of the real pioneers in that field. Now we come up to today, and here's a study from the German Cancer Research Center, DKEFZ, and the German Center for Diabetes Research, DZD. And they decided to try fasting. And they found that when they did fasting, they were able to show that upon deprivation of the food, that means you restrict the large amount of calories, a certain protein is produced that adjusts the metabolism in the liver. They published the results in open access journal EMBO Molecular Medicine. And the growing number of overweight people has long been one of the modern society's pressing issues. Obesity, overweight, is an epidemic pandemic in the United States, but also in India, in China, where they want the same diet Americans have. Now, in particular, resulting metabolic diseases such as type 2 diabetes and corresponding secondary conditions can have serious consequences for health. Quite simply, a reduced intake of calories, such as in the framework of an intermittent fasting diet, can help to whip the metabolism back into shape. But why does this happen? Well, this is the question that a Professor Herzig, director of the Institute of Diabetes and Cancer, wanted to find out. And he said that a protein metabolism in health and disease research group found that they understand how fasting will stimulate your metabolism, where it becomes therapeutic. So let me put this in kind of lay language. When you stimulate the body's metabolism, and you can do that through exercise, but you can also do it through caloric restriction, where you simply don't take any high caloric foods in that are junk foods, like potato chips and french fries and pizzas and hamburgers, hot dogs. Those are all high calorie, but low nutrition. Where instead, if you have a plant-based diet, you're taking in high density nutrients like your vitamins, phytonutrients, high fiber, moderate to low amino acids, which is what your body actually needs, but you don't have all those excess empty calories, you actually stimulate the metabolism. Hence, you're able to have a healthier metabolism. You burn weight, you clean the artery, you clean up the liver as well, and that allows you to live a longer life. So moderate fasting, even if you started one day a week of just having juices all day long, your metabolism can improve, your liver will improve, and your whole metabolic system improves. You have more energy, and that's the bottom line to that. Now, at a Yakult Central Institute in Japan, they found that by giving a probiotic to medical students during the run-up to the National Medical School examinations, reduced stress among the students. Quote, the probiotic strain Lactobacillus cassia strain, Shirota, S-H-I-R-O-T-A, can relieve many aspects of stress response, especially gastrointestinal dysfunction. And they published in the Applied and Environmental Microbiology, the Journal of the American Society of Microbiology. So in lay language, what's that mean? When we're stressed, we adversely affect our metabolism, our energy. For example, if you're stressed and you eat, you don't get good digestion absorption because you're in fight or flight mode. Visualize an animal. You got a predator, a lion. You got a prey, an antelope. The predator is strong, lives a short life, has enormous power, and has the ability to hunt with stealth, meaning the animal knows where the wind is and will go downwind instead of upwind so that you don't get the smell of the animal. The animal lunges, can run for a short distance, but not a long distance, can't jump. But once it grabs you, more often than not, you're going to be a meal. What do you think happens to the antelope? First, it lives a longer life. It's far faster. And the moment it senses that there's danger, it will stop digestion, frequently vacate its bowels, and run. all the energy through the cortisol is now in the muscle, in the heart, in its vision, smell. It has to know where it's running, how to run, and sustain the run, because if it slows down, its life is over. So its hormones are geared to that. Now, that's true in almost all predator-prey situations. But imagine you're at home at night. You're asleep. Suddenly you hear something. You sit up in bed. In that millisecond, your blood sugar has increased, your blood pressure has increased, your breathing has increased, your olfactory and all your body senses are at their height, your digestion stops, you're ready to fight or flee. And generally that lasts for maybe a half minute to a minute, a little longer. Now let's just imagine that you're studying for an exam or you're in a stressful situation. Same, identical stress hormones, but they don't turn off in a half minute or a minute and a half. They just keep pumping 24/7. And our adrenals burn out. And our energy goes down. And we just have to have caffeine and sugar to keep us going if you're the average person. So they're showing that probiotics, good probiotics, are able to create a bacterial medium in the intestine that has its own brain, has over 100 million neuron cells in the intestine, and is able to communicate to de-stress, even when you're mentally stressed. So it actually compensates and helps you. How about that? That just shows you another miracle of the body. I think it's just terrific. So if you're stressed, if you're student, or if you're just, if a person going through a rough time, then use those probiotics. And one final study from both Emory and Georgia State Universities show that probiotic supplements protected female mice from a loss of bone density that occurs after having their ovaries removed. This was done at the School of Medicine, published in the Journal of Clinical Investigation. So quite simply, probiotics help stop postmenopausal bone loss. And also I mentioned pomegranate. Pomegranate can serve as a backup ovary. So I always suggest eating pomegranate because it's great, but it's also great for the ovaries. And in fact, if you look at a pomegranate, it has a remarkable anatomical resemblance to the ovaries. And because of our primary relationship to fruit is as a consumer, we're usually too immersed in the joyful act of eating fruit to take notice of it by definition. The ripened ovary, together with the seeds from one of our more flowers of a plant, that's your pomegranate. The difference between species are obvious, of course. Fruit ovaries disperse their seeds by being eaten and then excreted by animals, whereupon human ovaries remaining intact within the body disperse their seeds, the eggs, by way of the fallopian tubes. So observing a cross-section of the pomegranate and the human ovary side by side, you can see the remarkable resemblance. And the ancient doctrine of signatures, that nature weaves itself in which it can recognize by many systems of traditional medicine around the world, makes it so that sometimes the edible portion of the plant, the food, will be of unique benefit to the organ of the body that it resembles. The walnut, for instance, has a skull-like protective casing enclosing the biohemisphere meat of its seed, which strikingly resembles the very human brain. Ever open up a walnut and see it? And it's rich in omega-3 fatty acids, which are neuroprotective. But they also did some work on the pomegranate and found that it's very nourishing to the ovaries. And it also is now being considered as an alternative to hormone replacement therapy. In fact, there was a study published in the Journal of Enthopharmacology where they tested this and found that it actually worked as if it were another ovary. And finally, talking about eating nuts, they've been linked, according to Seoul National University College of Medicine in Korea, to lowering your risk of colon cancer. Now, I'm referring to all types of preferably raw nuts, almonds, walnuts, macadamias, cashews, pistachios, pine nuts or pignolias, Brazilian nuts. They're all good. And it doesn't take a lot. 15 grams, that's just about a half an ounce is all they did in this study to show that it made a difference. So I wouldn't suggest that little amount. I would suggest more than that. But it made a huge difference in lowering the risk of colon cancer. And Sayer G. of Green Med Info says, a traditional plant food that has been used for thousands of years to improve health and well-being, quote, is finally being validated by science. The results, it may be far superior to chemotherapy as an agent which has deadly side effects and dubious efficacy. This does not. And so you looked at over 3,000 studies. And on the value of over 650 natural substances that are chemoprotective, chemopreventative. And this was published in Molecular and Cellular Biochemistry. And it shows that, for example, noni leaves or the morinda, citrifolia, that's noni, N-O-N-I, may be the ideal complementary therapy or functional food in the prevention of management of lung cancer. And I know some of you use noni, but others may not even know of it. That's just one. But there are others as well. And in fact, according to one study, lung cancer is the most lethal of all cancers by number worldwide. There are other cancers that side by side, like pancreatic cancer, would be more deadly. But lung cancer takes over 1,400,000 lives a year worldwide. And about 80% of these lung cancer cases are classified as non-small cell lung cancer. And conventional chemotherapy or radiation is notorious for failing to kill them due to the resistance. And yet, in some of these studies, you can have other plant-based nutrients that are used that are able to kill these cells. And that's terrific. And noni leaf is superior to chemotherapy in two experimental models for doing exactly that. There was a study entitled Metastasized Lung Cancer Suppression by Morindia citrifolia, that's noni leaf, compared to an anti-inflammatory chemotherapy agent. So just something to keep in mind, and I'll tell you more about others, including new research on cannabis oil, which is getting good results. And for those of you who don't think there's a bad effect of fructose and all those items you drink or eat, there is. It's your memory and learning. And there's new research that shows that everything is in the details when it comes to this. But the American College of Neuropsychopharmacology discovered that the brain responds very differently depending upon the type of sugar that you consume. Take, for example, fructose. When your brain is hit with this sugar, it excites the reward circuits in the brain, triggering a feeling of hunger whenever a food cue is present, like a television commercial for a restaurant. In contrast, when we ingest glucose, the brain reacts by prompting a feeling of satiety instead of hunger. And that's why the ads always show something that will trigger our hunger. And studies have established that glucose diminishes activity in the area of the brain called the hypothalamus, whereas fructose does not. The hypothalamus is in charge of a range of metabolic processes, including hunger and thirst. So you don't want to be taking in a lot of things with fructose, because if you do, you're going to stay perpetually hungry and perpetually thirsty, which means you're going to continue to eat more foods that you shouldn't eat and drink more things you shouldn't drink. So just stay away from it. It is a poison, bad to the bone. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and nutrition. We're going to take a brief break. Come right back. Got a lot to share. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world and throughout the United States listening on all the stations carrying us. Thank you. By the way, Friday we had a record number of people listening, and wow, did we have an interesting conversation with Ray McGovern. Just one of the most in-depth discussions that you've ever heard on a very important issue. So we thank you for listening over the telephone. We had people call our number, write this down. Every Friday you can listen in, or any day you can listen in at noon, 712-775-6850, 712-775-6850. I want to share something I believe we need to do. A very brief overview. I do not believe any of our political or educational or institutional systems can change through improvement based upon getting one or two people in local or national positions to make a difference. I believe you have to have a person that is absolutely obstinate and is disobedient in the extreme. Someone who, like a Jill Stein or Ralph Nader, a Chris Hedges, someone who has that kind of character but insight and says, if it's a bad idea and I make a compromise with you, it's still a bad idea. And I want to make an idea that's not a bad idea. Why can't we start with good ideas like universal health care? That's a good idea and is completely doable. We don't have to compromise. Why do we need this big military-industrial complex? We don't. Let's stop it. Why do we need to be all over the world? We don't. Why are we meddling other people's affairs? We shouldn't. Why are we spying on every single American every single second of every day and lying about it? Stop it. Close down these agencies. Close them down. We don't need them. We don't need 16 different agencies. How have we allowed our police to become militarized? Stop it. You know, take some cities and give them no weapons at all and show them how to go into a community and work with the community and find out how they can serve and protect the community. But we're not doing that. We need to be disobedient. Here's someone, Matt Damon, who shares his thoughts.
That the wrong people are in jail and the wrong people are out of jail. That the wrong people are in power and the wrong people are out of power. That the wealth is distributed in this country and the world in such a way as not simply to require a small reform, but to require a drastic reallocation of wealth. I start from the supposition that we don't have to say too much about this because all we have to do is think about the state of the world today and realize that things are all upside down. Now, if you don't think, if you just listen to TV and read scholarly things, you actually begin to think that things are not so bad, or that just little things are wrong. But you have to get a little detached and then come back and look at the world, and you are horrified. So we have to start from that supposition that things are really topsy-turvy. And our topic is topsy-turvy, civil disobedience. Now, as soon as you say the topic is civil disobedience, you're saying our problem is civil disobedience. That is not our problem. Our problem is civil obedience. Our problem is the numbers of people all over the world who have obeyed the dictates of the leaders of their government and have gone to war. And millions have been killed because of this obedience. We recognize this for Nazi Germany. We know that the problem there was obedience, that the people obeyed Hitler. People obeyed. That was wrong. They should have challenged, and they should have resisted. And if we were only there, we would have showed them. Even in Stalin's Russia, we can understand that. People are obedient. All these herd-like people. Remember those bad old days when people were exploited by feudalism? Everything was terrible in the Middle Ages. But now we have Western civilization, the rule of law. The rule of law has regularized and maximized the injustice that existed before the rule of law. That is what the rule of law has done. When in all the nations of the world, the rule of law is the darling of the leaders and the plague of the people, We ought to begin to recognize this. We have to transcend these national boundaries in our thinking. Nixon and Brezhnev have much more in common with one another than we have with Nixon. J. Edgar Hoover has far more in common with the head of the Soviet secret police than he has with us. It's the international dedication to law and order that binds the leaders of all countries in a comradely bond. That's why we're always so surprised when they get together. They smile, they shake hands, they smoke cigars. They really like one another, no matter what they say. What we are trying to do, I assume, is really to get back to the principles and aims and spirit of the Declaration of Independence. This spirit is resistance to illegitimate authority and to forces that deprive people of their life and liberty and right to pursue happiness. And therefore, under these conditions, it urges the right to alter or abolish their current form of government, and the stress had been on abolish. But to establish the principles of the Declaration of Independence, we're going to need to go outside the law, to stop obeying the laws that demand killing or that allocate wealth the way it's been done, or that put people in jail for petty technical offenses and keep other people out of jail for enormous crimes. My hope is that this kind of spirit will take place not just in this country, but in other countries, because they all need it. People in all countries need the spirit of disobedience to the state, which is not a metaphysical thing, but a thing of force and wealth. And we need a kind of declaration of interdependence among people in all countries of the world who are striving for the same thing.
Makes a lot of sense. My suggestion would be this. We do not know yet if Bernie Sanders will be a cop-out that Chris Hedges and others believe he will. He will simply turn over at the convention his candidates, his all of his supporters to Hillary Clinton. Or will he create a new party? He has a couple options. One would be bring in Jill Stein as his vice president's running mate, bring in the Green Party. Now, right now, the math is on his side. 22% of registered voters are conservative, 20%, 26 to 20% are Republican, and 41% are independent. Many of those independents will not vote for Trump and will not vote for Clinton, but they certainly would vote for someone who represents some real independent ideals. And so if Sanders wanted to and was truly independent, he would join forces with someone who, with his weaknesses, could provide some strengths and get that big base support going, and he would steamroll over either Clinton or Trump in the finals, even though the Green Party and Jill Stein's not in all of the different states, I think they're in 37 registered. It would be an overwhelming indictment against the current two-party system and would allow for a lot of new ideas to be put forth for future and start a new revolution. That would begin the American Revolution again, the American Spring. To give you an idea of how bad Donald Trump's ideas are when it comes to immigration, here's Robert Reich in a short piece challenging his statements.
Donald Trump has opened the floodgates to lies about immigration. Here are the myths and the facts. Myth: immigrants take away American jobs. Wrong. Immigrants add to economic demand and thereby push firms to create more jobs. Myth: we don't need any more immigrants. Baloney. The U.S. population is aging. 25 years ago, each retiree in America was matched by five workers. Now, for each retiree, there are only three workers. Without more immigration, in 15 years, the ratio will fall to 2 workers for every retiree, which is not nearly enough to sustain our retiree population. Myth. Immigrants are a drain on public budgets. Bull. Immigrants pay taxes. The Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy released a report this year showing undocumented immigrants paid $11.8 billion in state and local taxes in 2012. And their combined nationwide state and local tax contributions would increase by another $2.2 billion under comprehensive immigration reform. Myth. Legal and illegal immigration is increasing. Wrong again. The net rate of illegal immigration into the U.S. is less than zero. The number of undocumented immigrants living in the U.S. has actually declined from 12.2 million in 2007 to 11.3 million now, according to the Pew Research Center. Don't listen to the demagogues who want to blame the economic problems of middle class and poor on new immigrants, whether here legally or illegally. The real problem is the economic game is rigged in favor of a handful at the top who are doing the rigging. We need to pass comprehensive immigration reform, giving those who are undocumented a path to citizenship. Scapegoating them and other immigrants is shameful, and it's just plain wrong.
I would agree with that. Now I want to share something. Because one of the biggest concerns people have is about the future. And if you believe the technocrats, if you believe the talking heads, you'll believe that we are doing great, we're rebounding, we're not. Those are lies. The fact is that we have more right now, we have more unemployed people in America than we had during the Great Depression. We have more than 96 million Americans who could work and are not. And part of the reasons is that the jobs that do end up getting created are generally seasonal jobs, and many of them are in service industries. So you get minimal wage, and which cannot sustain you to go into the marketplace and buy something, spend money as you might have when things were fine. According to Michael Snyder, the U.S. firms announced 65,141 job cuts during April. Now, by the way, that's a 35% increase over the previous month. Well, look at it in another way. The job cut announcements are running 24% higher than from the same time a year ago. And unemployment claims have skyrocketed. They shot up dramatically. 17,000 new job claims just in the last week alone. Where are these jobs being lost at? Well, one of the top areas is computer firms, announced 16,923 job cuts just in the last 4 weeks. That's the highest total among all industries. This includes 12,000 from chipmaker Intel. And you have to understand there's a reason for this. Also, there's 100,000 jobs that have been lost over the last year in the energy industry, and that's just the beginning of it, because you have an enormous bubble, a debt bubble. Let me explain. When oil was at $115 a barrel, if you could process a barrel of oil, take it out of the ground, and then process it and ship it for, let's say, $65, look at the amount of profit you made. So when things were good in heady days, they went to the banks, or they went to different groups, or groups came to them, hedge funds, and said, how much money do you need? Well, we could use $2 billion, $5 billion, not a problem. And the only collateral they could put on that to service all this and guarantee it was the value of future earnings, the value of their equipment, the lease and the title to their oil fields, etc. Well, that was good as long as the price of oil was up over $100, but now it's jumping anywhere from $38 to $45 a barrel. Probably as long as it's under $50, all these people are dead. And that means that hundreds of thousands of workers are going to lose their job. The corporations that had hired them are going bankrupt. The banks that gave them the money are going to go bankrupt or go to the Federal Reserve and ask for help. So in plain English, millions of Americans' jobs are at risk, and they're not coming back, not in these areas. That leads me to something that I think we should understand. First, you've got two problems occurring that are not being discussed by anyone, which is surprising. One is the visa program. Now, this is allowing a person who has a certain group of qualifications the corporation wants to come into the United States and work, but they work at a lot less money than someone whose job they're taking. So these are generally highly qualified people with frequently PhDs who are willing to work for $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year and take the place of someone who's been making $100,000, $150,000, $200,000 a year. And there are 8 million of these people. What the largest single decrease in employment is coming from people's jobs being taken by other qualified people. And yet you rarely hear about this, but these are people whose kids are frequently going to college or Ivy League schools, who have a second home, who have a very high quality of life and a standard of living, and once they get that job cut, there's no way in the world they're going to find another place. It's not possible to lose your job in the United States and come back and get another comparable job if you're one of those high-end earners. Those jobs are gone, and they're never coming back. And there's a reason why. Because corporations value the logo, the trademark, the image, not the product. The product they can take from Dearborn, or they can take it from Flint, or they can take it from Chattanooga, and they can ship it to China and make it for one-fifth the cost, which improves their profit. They can strip off all the employees, including getting rid of pensions and benefits and all the sick days they've accumulated and vacation days. All that goes out the window because new people coming in get none of that. So now it makes them look really smart because they're making more profit, but the profit isn't coming because they're selling more product. It's because they have squeezed all the juice out of that orange they can. And then you have the big problem. According to Barry Lando, in an article in Counterpunch, and by the way, Barry Lando is a former producer at 60 Minutes, he says the following, quote, "A perfect technological storm, the awesome threat you won't hear about in America's presidential campaign. For a huge number of Americans, the key emotion driving the tortured primary campaign is arguably even fear. It's fear of terrorism, fear of immigrants. But above all, it's fear, panic of some, of Americans whose standard of living has declined or stagnated and who apprehend an even bleaker future for their children. But the candidates and most of the media are ignoring the real cause of that angst. We are, in fact, swept up in a vast technological tsunami. It's a tsunami bearing challenges as great as anything our species has ever known. It has already swept away millions of jobs and will wipe out tens of millions more. It will totally transform the economic landscape and, like climate change, could conceivably threaten our very existence. But if you tune in to the cacophony that currently passes for political debate in the United States and much of Europe, you hear precious little about that massive, relentless threat. Instead, there are tirades against immigrants, against supposedly disastrous international trade deals, and ruthless businessmen who close domestic factories to exploit labor in sweatshops abroad, against a political and economic system crafted to make the top 0.01% even more obscenely rich. There is some truth to all these charges, but the fact is that the real culprit, the underlying Teutonic force transforming everything, is something completely different. It's technology unleashed as never before. It has been labeled the second machine age, the fourth industrial revolution, and has long been the stuff of science fiction, but its impact is no longer a distant menace. A study by Citibank and researchers from Oxford University released last January concluded that 47% of jobs in America are at risk of being replaced by robots and artificial intelligence, while across the OECD, an average of 57% of jobs are threatened. In China, the menace of automation soars to 77%. That onrushing maelstrom is the product of what we call a perfect technological storm. It's been unleashed by recent astounding increases in computing power, magnified by startling advances in ability to store, retrieve, analyze, and transmit data, and reinforced almost daily, it seems, by stunning breakthroughs in fields like AI, robotics, nanotechnology, meteorology, microbiology, and 3D printing. There are those who step in at this point to reassure us that there's no need for panic. From the first days of the Industrial Revolution, technological change has always been feared and fought. Yet the innovations have always wound up creating far more jobs than they destroyed. Mankind has only prospered, they say. Thus, the argument goes, though huge numbers of jobs will be eliminated by AI and robots, in the long run, many more jobs, entirely new professions and industries will be created dispensing products and services we can't even fathom today. But the fact is, the current perfect storm of technology doubling the rate of progress every decade is unlike anything we've ever known before, and it's now approaching warp speed. According to futurists like Ray Kurzweil, just in the 21st century alone, quote, we will witness on the order of 20,000 years of progress when measured by today's rate of progress, or about 1,000 times greater than what was achieved in the 20th century. World Economic Forum recently released a report concluding that the rise of the robots will lead to a net loss of 5 million jobs and by the next 3.5 years. 3.5 years. The BBC has posted an interactive site that allows you to check just how likely it is that your own job will be wiped out in the next 15 years. Some jobs, surprisingly, most at risk are bank loan officers. Good for them. 90% will be eliminated. Paralegals, 94%. Retail salespeople, 92% of all retail salespeople will be gone. Taxi drivers and chauffeurs, 89%. In fact, completely driverless cars are already being tested on California highways. Also high on the list are fast food cooks and bartenders, 77%, security guards, 75%, and even personal financial advisors, 58%. Airline pilots and flight engineers, 25%, gone. But already with automation, it is estimated the average pilot actually controls the plane himself only 3 to 7 minutes per flight. For the time being, human reporters and writers might appear to still have a future. Yet even now, it depends on what kind of reporter you're talking about. Thousands of company earning reports and detailed accounts of sporting events are already being entirely written by AI-equipped robots. There's even an automated service that daily scans and analyzes mammoth amounts of media, from mainstream publications to the most obscure newsletters and blogs, and then alerts investigative journalists and their editors to what might be potentially bombshell reports. Donald Trump darkly threatens a trade war with China as payback for its rapacious trade practices and sweatshop wages. But the fact is that many manufacturing jobs supposedly lost to China were wiped out because of technological advances in the United States itself and will never be regained. Ironically, it is China that has already become the largest market for the world of robots, threatening millions of its own factory workers. One stunning example is Foxconn, the Taiwanese firm that makes iPhones and has more than 1 million employees in China. Both they and Apple have been criticized for their low salaries and minimal working conditions. No longer, they now aim to have robots replacing 70% of their massive assembly line workforce within 3 years. Last year, their CEO boasted they already have a fully automated factory in the Chinese city of Chengdu that can run 24 hours a day with the lights off and no employees. Perhaps some of those displaced workers may wind up manufacturing robots themselves. So, there you have it. Two sides of the equation. One, you have highly skilled people with great educations coming in willing to work for very little compared to people who thought they were tenured, thought that they had seniority, gone. There goes your upper middle and professional classes. We have 6 million of those people now at risk. Then you have automation. And then on top of all that, you have the weather. And the weather could be the deciding factor. Droughts are going to create a desert that goes beyond anything we have ever comprehended as a world population. Right now, there are 500 million people who are unable to have regular clean drinking water. There's 1.2 billion food insecure people. That's a lot of people. A lot will die. The world will never know they were alive. But those who do find that they get to a place where there's ample water and food, and it's not given to them, that's where you're going to have your flashpoints and riots. Will it come to America? It's coming to America. Just not yet. It will. I've said it many times. I'll say it one last time today. We're not enough pain to protest. We're not enough pain to change. We're just too comfortable with everything, except for a small 1% of the population. That'll change radically when nature awakens us. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.